For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
And so I want to talk a little bit about the idea of adequacy, just sort of in a general sense, and then we'll get into our passage and talk about how Paul develops this idea. Adequacy. What is adequacy, anyway? What is adequacy? What does it mean to be adequate? Well, the way that it's the Greek word is used and the way that it's translated in the New Testament is kind of around this idea of competence. In fact, I think the New International Version, if you have that, does translate in this paragraph, the two paragraphs we're going to look at tonight, not adequate, but competent. Acceptability, sufficiency, confidence, all those things are wrapped up together in this idea of adequacy that we're going to be probing into here tonight. And maybe the best way to get at what does adequacy really mean and what does adequacy look like is when we think about it by contrast, namely what happens when there's that strong sense of adequacy that's lacking in your life, that you are deeply and maybe profoundly aware of just how inadequate you really are. And some of us maybe are maybe in better touch with this than others, but a few things came to my mind, that a person who really feels persistently a sense of inadequacy is a person who is likely going to be suffer poor performance in the tasks that they're about. And why is that? Why would they suffer, performance problems? It's because they don't have that belief that, yeah, if I apply myself, I really can succeed in this endeavor. And so it's easy to quit and say the heck with it, maybe to poo-poo the idea to begin with. That's the whole sour grapes thing is basically this awareness of a lack of adequacy. Some people live their whole lives this way. I've met people, brilliant people, talented people, really interesting people who just because of their own sense of inadequacy have never risked beyond a very rudimentary level in relationship, in career, and a lot of different things in life. They're not able to be the kind of people that they were designed to be because of that pervasive sense of inadequacy. People who are dealing in a significant way, in a persistent way, with inadequacy in their life are often very easily manipulated. Why would this be? Well, because, if you are always sort of feeling like you're just not up for the task, if you are just fundamentally inadequate, then the strong voices of confidence with people around you become very persuasive, and the tendency is then for a person who lacks adequacy to be more or less strong-armed into doing things sometimes that they would not even within their own conscience choose to do. And so there are relationships even, long-term relationships, sometimes marriage relationships, where one or sometimes both of the spouses are driven by this profound sense of inadequacy and are just overwhelmed by the personality of the person that they're married to. And this is really a bad scene. The person who suffers from a strong sense of inadequacy is a person who's super negative about themselves. And you sit down and you talk to them and it's like, so how's it going? Sucks. Really? Yeah. There's just a dark lining around everything that there is. These are not people whose glass is half empty. This is a person whose glass has gone bone dry. See, that's the kind of person we're dealing with. And, to the extent that you can kind of connect in your own thoughts about being inadequate, there's something that we really need to kind of grasp as we think this through. Then, too, there is on the other end, I think, false ideas of adequacy. Or what does it look like when a person, maybe wants to be adequate but senses within themselves that they are not. And we all know the braggart, the arrogant person. Why is an arrogant person arrogant? It's because, they realize their weaknesses. They realize that they don't have it together and they've got a lot to prove. And so they strut their feathers and they try to project an aura of somebody that they would like to be, but who deep down inside, they know they aren't. It's a good rule of thumb. The more arrogant a person is that you're interacting with, the more deeply insecure that person is, the more they're trying to convince themselves of something that they really don't believe after all. Another thing that I think is a mask for adequacy that people experience, that I experience, is that when we operate really only in the areas of our strengths, and we will do that often to compensate for these areas for which we know we are inadequate, and that we maybe worry about and fear. Like, for example, a lot of guys feel, you know, pretty adequate at work, or relatively adequate at work. Or let's just say this, by comparison to at home, much more adequate. And so it's super easy then to orient your time, your emotional life, the things that you value around the functional things that you can perform that are within your control. But then that whole other area of life, like the relational dimension, like that ability to establish warmth and connection with other people. Well, that, you know, there we don't feel very adequate for that. So what do? We just erase that out of our life. Problem solved. Right? You know, here's the thing that I see a lot of times with women who have careers, which is the vast majority, of course, today. When they have children and some elect to stay home, maybe suspend their career or diminish it to a significant extent for a period of time to be home with children. You know, there is that, what the hell am I doing with my life? Kind of response that moms oftentimes feel pretty guilty about, because it's like, I shouldn't be feeling this way. What we're facing is this sense of inadequacy that we're unaccustomed to. We're used to being competent and capable and having real markers of success as we climb up the corporate ladder, but you don't feel that kind of success when you're up at night with bottles and changing diapers and stuff like that. Okay? So we make some choices to basically marginalize those areas of life that we don't feel a sense of adequacy about, and we emphasize those things that we do, and as a consequence, we really distort what does it mean for us to be the person that God has made us. And so I think we all kind of struggle in various areas in this realm of adequacy. I think that what Paul is going to say to us tonight really does make a difference. And when I ask this question, just again to kind of get us into the topic, when we talk about lacking a strong sense of adequacy, or when we look at, you know, things that may appear in some ways to be a sense of adequacy but which are really not, what do those things have in common? What do you think they have in common, each of those things? I think there's a thread that runs through all of them. What do you think?
We draw our identities from the things that we do.
Yeah. We draw our identity from the things that we do. So it's all about performance defines adequacy. And so when we feel like our performance is threatened, that's where that sense of inadequacy comes in. And it's true across the board. I think it's exactly right. What else would be a common thread that runs through this?
In all those, the focus is on yourself.
Yeah. That's right. It's my adequacy. It's what I'm doing. It's exactly right. Anybody else have a thought on this? I agree with both of those. What do you think, Joe?
You're comparing yourself to your peers, how you stack up against your workmates, whoever you're, that environment that you're in.
Yep. Absolutely. It's comparison, comparative.
I think there might be inability to deal with reality, that if you are staring failure in the face, that it's too much for us, and we panic and try to get around it because failure is too devastating. It's too close to who we are.
Okay, good. I think what Andrea is saying is that there's always this kind of voice in the back of our head saying, what you're doing is really not adequate. You're really not getting the job done. I agree with that. I sense that quite a bit. What do you think, Torque?
I was thinking that in each of these categories, all the strength, all the power has to come from you alone.
Yeah.
That you have no outside source.
Yep. And I think that's what Gabe was saying, too. It begins and ends with you. And so that sets us up, I think, for some things to think about from this text. Because I agree. When I thought about this earlier, I was thinking that adequacy in each of these cases is earned or merited. And there's that corresponding sense that what if I don't add up? What if I don't earn enough? What if I am not highly functional and successful and capable? What happens with my adequacy then? And then, of course, the enormous pressure that we put upon ourselves. I have to make myself adequate. And what's going to happen in false ideas of adequacy, in the recognition of the lack of real sense of adequacy in our lives, in each case, is that we're led to bitter failure in important areas of our life. Bitter failure in important areas of our life. And so this is the kind of mind thought frame that Paul was dealing with when he was thinking about these Corinthians. And Paul, you know, for all of his greatness, here's a guy who was profoundly affected by these people, who was deeply intimidated, and for whom going back to this whole question of adequacy was a very important thing for him to do. Let's take a look at the kind of the keystone verse in this passage. In chapter 3, verse 5, Paul says, "Not that we are adequate in ourselves to consider anything as coming from ourselves," he says, "but our adequacy is from God, who has made us adequate as servants of a new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit, for the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life." Now, what is Paul saying here about adequacy, and how does that relate to the discussion we were having a minute ago? Two things. The first is that the issue of adequacy begins with our identity. It really engages this question, am I adequate? What is it saying about me? And that's pretty important, because what does he say in verse 5? He says, not that we are adequate in ourselves to consider anything as coming from ourselves. In other words, in answer to this question, how adequate are you? From God's point of view, you're not very adequate at all. From God's point of view, when you look at yourself and you ask, am I adequate? You know, which is a deep question, a probing question, a question that every human being, you know, has to sort of work through in their own mind. You know, it's why young people, as they are growing up, do the kinds of things they do to establish the sense of identity, to establish a sense of uniqueness and so forth. They are asking this question, am I adequate? And what does Paul say? Well, actually, no. You're not adequate. You're not adequate. What does he mean by that? He points to the measure of adequacy that God has revealed in his word, which is the law. He says, the letter kills. If we are looking for adequacy based upon it's all about me, and it's about I go out there and I earn it, you know, the old-fashioned way. And what I do, it defines who I am. And I'm adequate because I do these things that make me look good, or at least in some way better than the next person. The law is there to say, you fail. The law is, you know, and here he's referring to the Old Testament law, the 613 laws that make up the law of Moses. And he says, if you want to know what does it look like to be adequate before God, that's what it looks like. And you fail. Okay, good. So you don't fail like the next person does, and you're not a murderer, and good for you. But what about your coveting, your desire to have what doesn't belong to you? What about your idolatry? What about, you know, all these things that are driving you into a self-oriented, selfish way of living. The law is there to say, you are not adequate. That if we're going to understand the biblical concept of adequacy, it begins with the recognition of how far from adequate I really am. So Paul, in context, can't be looking to how hard he has worked on behalf of the Corinthians to say, wow, you know, I'm really adequate because, I mean, look how much I've tried. Look at these cool things I've written to them. None of that matters. Not that we are adequate in ourselves to consider anything as coming from ourselves. That's a pretty extreme statement, isn't it? That includes all things. You know, the religious person wants to say, I'm adequate before God because I'm a good person. I try hard. How hard do you try? How good are you really? The law says, not enough. You fail. Okay? So, stick that in your pipe and smoke it for a while. See what that does to your sense of adequacy. He's bringing us down. Because he's destroying what we prop ourselves up with, the comparisons against other people's behavior, superficial religious devotion, things like that that we look to say, I'm really okay, when really we're not. The cool thing is that if we are really prepared to come before God and to say, man, I know I'm not adequate, that's a charade. You know, I'm really not this way. In my heart, I know how screwed up I really am. Then we are at that point prepared for the other message that God gives to us, which is that, as he says here at the end of verse 5, he says our adequacy comes from God. It is God who makes us adequate, acceptable, competent. God makes us adequate. How does he do that? It says, not by the letter of the law, he says, but by the Spirit. And here he's making a contrast then between the letter that kills, he says, which we'll talk about in some detail next week, that the law was never given to make us better. It was to show us how screwed up we really are. And if we get that message, then we're prepared for a different message, which is that God wants to give us, not through our merit, not because we earn it, but he wants to give us something that we can receive, namely real life that comes by his Spirit. And that's where we're going to find adequacy at a wholly different level. See, Paul here is using the language and the promise that is in the Old Testament prophets as they envision this time when God is going to change the way human beings relate to him. In Ezekiel chapter 36, this is a fantastic passage, verses 25 and 26, it says, I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you will be clean. You ever felt just like, I don't know, dirty? Not like because you didn't take a bath, but because inwardly you know, man, I'm just full of filth. Well, that's the imagery that Ezekiel's using here. He's saying that God is saying, I will sprinkle you clean and you will be clean. And I will cleanse you from all your filthiness and from all of your idols. And moreover, he says, I will give you a new heart and I will put a new spirit within you. And I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. See, God's not into like changing our behavior, making us work harder, erasing our slate so that we can try harder the next time. You know, those are men's solutions to our fundamental inadequacy. And God's is to say, I want to make you adequate. I make you adequate. I have completely forgiven you. And more than that, I've created something new to operate in your being. A heart of flesh, as he says. It's like, man, that stone cold heart is gone and something warm and life-giving is there. The Spirit of God in our lives. A basis for adequacy? Yeah, it's this. Not what I've done for me, but what God has done on my behalf. That is where we start. That's where it matters. So your adequacy, your acceptability has nothing to do with what you do. You've got nothing to prove. If adequacy comes as a gift from God, on the basis of his grace and on the basis of his mercy, you don't have anything to boast about, that's true, but you don't have anything to fear either. You got nothing to prove to anybody. You are adequate because God has made you that way. So you're looking at the failures in your marriage and the failures in your parenting and the failures in your close relationships and the failures in your attempts to serve other people, and you've got a legacy of failure. Hey, guess what? Welcome to the club. You're kind of like Paul in that regard. But with Paul, we need to be able to say, look, I've got nothing to prove. Because my adequacy is completely sealed up in God. Now, here's the question then, I guess. Why would that matter to Paul at this stage of his life? Why would it matter for Paul to go back to this very basic truth about where our adequacy comes from? In the situation that Paul's in, who cares? What difference does it make? What do you think? Why would it matter?
Well, I think it matters because, I mean, like, he's trying to love them. And if he can't prove it, you know, out of, like, what he's able to do, he's going to have to go another route with them to keep their trust, to keep this relationship open, because they're giving him a reason to leave it.
Yeah. It's a good point. Excellent. Thanks. Who else has a thought? Why does it matter? We go back to this very basic point.
Well, it seems like just before this passage, there are some other people trying to tell the Corinthians something, and it comes down to an attitude of humility, I guess. I'm learning in my parenting, having left a successful career, that viewing my failure as an opportunity to be dependent upon God is a really cool thing. But it's really hard because I have to be able to say, this is hard and I'm not good at it, but it's not about whether I'm good at it or not. I've got to be dependent on God.
Okay, exactly.
And so it seems like he's talking about humility. I don't know.
And identity. Okay, so I'm not the high performance, professional sports, physical therapist chick. I'm the up all night barfing baby changing diapers chick. And how do I weigh myself in the balance? If I'm extracting my identity from either one of those things, I've lost it. And I've got to be able to say I'm valuable for who I am and where I am in relation to God, not in relation to all these things that I do. And Paul is the same way. And there's something super liberating that comes to a person when they begin to realize that that's the case. Now, I'm not using the people that God brings in my life to succeed and to extract that sense of adequacy or purpose that I can only really get from God himself. Yeah.
I was just thinking about this in that, you know, it's, I went through something where I was trying to do, and I'm not like this high power career person. It was just more, I like to get my adequacy through my relationships.
Okay.
And God took that away from me. And all of a sudden, I had to recognize that his love and what he's done for me was all that I needed to realize, because it wasn't what I could do to get him to love me. And like, it was what he did for me.
It's the one thing that can never be taken away from you.
Right.
Good. Let's... last point, Torg, and then we'll move on.
I was just thinking that this matters to Paul because if you don't get this right, everything you build will collapse. And so it's vital, and I imagine he brings it up at the beginning because this gets done properly or nothing will really get done.
Okay, exactly. And that's where he's going with this, too. let's shift gears a little bit. There's the adequacy about who am I, and then there's adequacy relating to the task. And he says here, our adequacy is from God, who has made us adequate, not just before him, but as servants of the new covenant. And so now it's a task-oriented kind of adequacy that he's referring to here. And here's the weird point. In context, where he says that nothing, our adequacy does not come from ourselves, the paradox that Christians are going to have to think about in a deep way if we're about accomplishing significant things in our lives for God is that we are adequate to the task. We are adequate to the task. When? Only when you realize that you're not. It's when you start thinking that you are adequate for the task, that you will fail. Because why? Because then it's all about you, your resources, your strength, your intelligence, your personality, your persuasiveness. And none of that stuff is going to matter in the long haul. That's what Paul's saying here. Look, if you want to do things that are really matter, that are world-changing, realize how impotent you are. That you are adequate at that point, at that important pivot in your mind and in your heart, when you realize how incredibly inadequate I really am. What does that mean, tangibly? What it means is that we need to cultivate deep interdependency on God in our life. What does that mean, to cultivate deep interdependency on God in our lives? What it means is that we're going before God and we're saying, God, here are the things that I believe you've brought into my life, that these people have real needs, and you've placed me there to meet those needs and to represent you effectively. And I just want to admit to you, God, I can't do that. I can represent Jim Leffel really well, but they don't need Jim Leffel in their life. They need you. And I don't know how to do that, God. And so I'm asking, give me your wisdom. Give me your heart for these people, because I don't have your heart for them. I'm a selfish, self-oriented, narcissistic, well, whatever, you guys know me. Okay? And it's about going before God in this way, in this kind of consistent way. You know, not just every now and then, but throughout our day. God, give me your eyes to see. God, give me your heart for these people. God, bring to remembrance the things that you have taught me and how those things might relate to the people that I'm called upon by you to care for. And I just want to place myself, God, in your service. I'm available to you. You know, and as we present ourselves to God in this way, and as we are very attuned to the fact that what really qualifies us to make a difference for God in this world is not our incredible abilities, but the quality of the depth of our relationship with God, the authenticity of that relationship, the sense of those around me that there is something real going on in my life, then we have, you know, that sense that yes, God is fashioning me to be adequate for the challenge that we have before us. Now, I realize I'm talking in relatively abstract terms at this point. And so what we need to do is ask ourselves, what does that really look like? What am I talking about here? What does it mean to cultivate God's adequacy and not my own? And how does that then make a real substantial difference, practically speaking, in the lives of the people that we're called on to serve? Well, that goes back to the early part of this passage then. In chapter 2, verse 14, Paul says, "Thank God, who always leads us in triumph in Christ and manifests through us the sweet aroma of the knowledge of him in every place. For we are a fragrance of Christ to God among those who are being saved and among those who are perishing. To the one, an aroma from death to death. To the other, an aroma from life to life." And he says, who could be adequate for these things? There's our theme again. What is Paul saying? He's saying you got to think about the Christian life as sort of being a part of what he calls the triumph of Christ. And he's using here language that the Romans would use when, after a great victory, military victory, you know, the conquering general and sometimes the emperor with him would enter into the city of Rome, and it would be this huge parade. And before, you know, at the front end of the parade are all the spoils of war, the prizes and stuff that they got, the gold and all that kind of stuff. And then there would be the soldiers, and behind them would be the captives that were taken prisoner. And Paul saying, you know, that's kind of like where it's at for us, that we're a part of God's triumphal victory march in Christ. And that, you know, in the ancient world, when they would have these victory marches, there would be this very fragrant, pungent even, incense. And that would serve a couple of purposes. One, it would be, you know, to really mark in people's minds, you know, the smell of victory, you know, literally, it is that. But also because, you know, the stench of death is there. And the death, dead soldiers, the captives that were either dying or on their way to execution, you know, and this type of thing. And Paul says, you know, it's kind of like that. That is, you know, a mark. He says, who's adequate for these things? No one's adequate, but God makes us adequate in the sense that we are like him, like a fragrant aroma. We're kind of like that incense that draws people. It's the smell of victory that we're about. And what he's talking about here is what some have referred to as sort of a subjective witness. Something about healthy, vital, growing Christians who are aware of our adequacy that comes from God, that people around them sense something real is going on in their lives. That a person who understands my adequacy really comes from God, not because of the things that I do for God, is able to be relaxed. They're able to be focused and confident, you know, and that because they don't have anything to prove. There's nothing to prove. It's just God has entered into my life, and God has begun to make a real reformation from within. And that's really all I want to share with you. That's all I want you to know. We don't have to fight about this. It's not an argument, you know. There's that relaxed feel when a person really does understand grace at this point. And a confidence, too, that I have met the living God. And so people sense that in this kind of person. Around a person who understands the adequacy that we have in Christ, gives off the, that smell of reality that others can perceive. You know, I think it's interesting that he uses olfactory images here. Did you know that psychologists tell us that the most enduring memories a person has comes through their sense of smelling? Did you know that? I had a weird experience, like when my wife and I first got married. I think this is the first time. We had a gas stove. See, I grew up in a house, you know, that was electric, because that was modern and that was where it was at. And first time we turned that on, I was like, man, I've smelled that before. And I remembered almost instantly at being maybe 2 or 3 years old at my grandmother's house the first time I smelled a gas stove. And it was an incredibly vivid memory that I had that got cued by, you know, this later thing. And what is Paul saying? He's saying, you know, in the same kind of way that when people get around a believer in Christ who understands their adequacy in him, that they smell something, and it's powerful and it's memorable and it doesn't go away. And you can argue and you can disparage this person all you want, but at the end of the day, in your heart, you know there's something real about this person and that I'd like to have some of that myself. And I have found great comfort in this, having lost many debates with people who are thinking about Christianity and stuff like that, thinking, oh man, I lost the opportunity, it's over, or whatever. But no, what does Paul say here? That people are able to sense the spiritual reality of God's people when we are really trusting in Him. That there's a ring of truth in what is being said. That there is a sense even of what God is really like and what God's intentions for people are through a Christian who is really understanding that their adequacy comes as a gift from God, not something that they earn. So there's just something kind of freeing about this. And Paul, having experienced great failure, can say, you know, at the end of the day, since it's not about me anyway, why would I call this a failure? Right? Because God is manifesting Himself, as it says, through me. How do you smell? How do you smell? Do you smell like the person who's laboring and fighting internally and maybe externally to make themselves acceptable, to make themselves adequate, to make themselves competent? Are you going to smell like sweat? Or will you have that pleasing fragrance of the person who really just is able to stand in the presence of unmerited favor by God, who realizes I'm here as a vehicle to be used by God, and I trust in fact that as I pursue Him, that He is using me, and at the end of the day, that is really what it matters the most. That's a different kind of life. He says in verse 15, you know, we are a fragrance of Christ to God among those who are being saved and among those who are perishing, to the one aroma from death to death and the other aroma of life to life. What does he mean here? He means that sense of spiritual reality that does pervade the life of a person who knows God in a deep way is very attractive and very pleasing to people who are lost, who know they are lost, and who are really seeking, you know, authentically spiritual answers in their life. They just sense around this person, man, there's something real there. I need to learn what they found. I need to check that out. But then, too, he says, you know, there's also the people who smell that and they think, oh, God, makes me want to puke. Oh, you know, ugh. Why? Because I'm about me. I don't have any room in my life for anyone but me. I'm my own God. I like it that way. I want to control my own little pathetic universe. And God to me is a threat. Then that smell is very different in the nostrils of a person like that. It's very bracing against the pride of the person who says, I'm going to do it my way on my own, who says, I'm going to live my own reality that I create or whatever. It's very troubling along those lines. But I think it's also crucial that we understand how tricky of an area this is, that having negative response from our neighbors around us to our desires to serve them and to manifest Christ to them, you know, that may not be met very eagerly. But that does not necessarily mean what we've just described here. Maybe what it means is that they are associating you with a backlog of experiences about what they think Christianity is that really is not Christianity at all. You see what I'm saying? And it's very important that we are able to say what I'm not talking about is the church thing. What I'm not talking about is being good. What I'm not talking about is trying harder. What I'm not talking about is being intolerant. What I'm not talking about is self-righteous. You know, because that's what people associate Christianity with. That's just a fact. And we have got to be able to communicate the grace and the love of God and the desire that God has, the passionate desire God has to meet everyone where they are and have that personal relationship with them. Last point. He says, and now he's going right to one of the key objections that some of these Corinthians had with him. He says, we are not like many peddling the word of God. They were accusing him of basically being in it for the money, which he says he wasn't. He says, but as from sincerity before God, we speak of Christ in the sight of God. So are we beginning to commend ourselves again? Is he boasting? Or do we need, he says, as some do, letters of commendation to you or from you? He says, you are our letter written in our hearts, known and read by all, being manifested that you are a letter of Christ cared for by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on the tablets of human hearts. This, he says, is our confidence that we have through Christ toward God. What an incredible saying this is. He's talking here about his sincerity before God, the confidence that he has about his relationship with these people before God. And he says, are you saying that we need letters of commendation to you or from you? In the ancient world, if you are going to speak to a group of people in an authoritative way, you have to have a letter of commendation. It says, this is who I am. This is my resume. This is why I'm qualified to speak to you and why you should listen to me. Okay? And Paul says, do I need a letter like that from somebody for you? He says, of course not. You yourselves, you are my letter. You are my letter of commendation. What's the clearest indication of real sincerity and real confidence that Paul is pointing to here? He says in verse 2, you are our letter written in our hearts, known and read by all, being manifested that you are a letter of Christ cared for by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of human hearts. Oh, how do you know? How do you know that God has made you adequate as his servant in the life of another person? How do you know? How do you know that God has made you adequate? This is the answer right here. The measure of our adequacy is the answer to the question, whose name is carved into your heart? I don't need a letter etched in pen saying, this is why I'm such a great person and that you should listen to me. I don't need to show you my resume of qualifications, my publication record, all my great things that are true about me. Because why? Because who cares? That's why. What really matters, what really makes us adequate, what really enables us to be used of God in a profound way is not all the qualification that we bring to the table. There are tools that we need, to be able to function effectively in people's lives. But at the bottom line, what is the core credential? It is that we have allowed the life of another person to penetrate into our being, into the depth of who we are. That our heart reflects their name. That we love them. That who they are has become profoundly a part of who I am. Do you want to make a difference for Jesus Christ to people in this world? What is the central criterion? What will make you adequate? You let them etch their name in your heart. You let them in. Boy, my mom, a couple of years ago, had bypass surgery. You want to read that? This is gruesome stuff. She was like 80 years old. They put this big cut down her chest, and then like jaws of life things on the rib cage. What did they do? They rip open your rib cage after sawing through your sternum to get access to the heart. What am I saying? If you want another name etched into your heart, it's going to hurt. Their lives matter, and therefore their struggles matter. Their concerns matter. Their lostness matters. Their confusion matters. Because it's not just their stuff, it's yours too. Man, there's no way you can go out and get accredited and credentialed for this kind of adequacy. There's no school that will give you the diploma of an etched heart. And yet Paul's saying, look, you know, as I stand before you and I listen to your accusations, I realize it's not all about me, that real adequacy comes from God Himself, and that your accusations toward me, they're like, they bounce off because I look at my own heart and sure enough, man, there's your names right there. You can say I've abandoned you. You can say that I'm a huckster. You can say whatever you want, but I know, man, your name is deep in the recesses of my heart. And I'm telling you, there is a power that comes from that. If you love people in this way, it is possible to not be moved even if by their rejection. I don't say that easily. I understand how that feels to love another person more than I love myself and to see that person go, you know, pfft, painful. But you can withstand that. And you can continue to move towards them. Because it's not about you. It's about them because it's their name that's written into your heart. You see what I'm saying? It's a deep truth. But it is the fundamental qualifying truth to do anything of significance for God. And so our question to end things is how does that happen? How does that happen? How does another person's name get etched into your heart? How does that happen? It's not a rhetorical question. I'm asking you. How does that happen?
Mutual vulnerability.
Mutual vulnerability etches the name of another in your heart. And what do you mean by that?
Well, I was going to say vulnerability, but I think it, like friendships. I mean, some of my longest and deepest friendships are, I mean, I think about them over time, and it's just, there's so much that has been shared in those friendships, and from the deepest lows, you know, a lot of deep lows, and it's just, you know, I feel honored and blessed to call them my friend because they've felt that they could share things with me that they couldn't share with anyone else, knowing that I wasn't going to judge them, that, you know, I was going to stick with them and help them in any way that I could.
Okay, so what you're saying, I think there's something really crucial here, which is that to the extent that we are able to extend grace to another person, and I love you, and I accept you, and I value you, not for what you've done, not what you can do, not what you will do, but for who you are, then I can let you in. But if I am standing in judgment over you, if I've put you into a category, if I've said you're this kind of person, then I will always treat you as an object outside. It's a very important point. Who else has a thought?
A lot of times, for me, it's asking God for that love and for that just heart for them, because it seems like that a lot of people who I'm the closest to, they're the furthest away from my personality and from who I would have chosen to love. And it's all God.
Supernatural. Yes, that's been my experience too. As you pray for a person and you say, Lord, give me your heart for them, help me understand them in a deep way, you begin to develop an affection for them. And you actually, there's a sense of desire then driving the relationship. I want to find out more. I want to be in their life. I agree. I think that's exactly how it works. Jen, you got a thought?
Yeah, I was just thinking, clearly I think like what people are saying, it starts with that relationship with God. But I think for me, a huge part of it then too is initiation. Like, it's not just going to happen if I sit back and watch. Mm-hmm. But I actually have to make conscious choices and decisions to choose to think about other people or spend time with someone else. So I think it also takes a level of willful decision.
Okay, making them part of your world. Yeah, I think that's right. I thought a lot about the fact that you know, the people that I am really deeply close to are people that I've said in my own heart and in my mind, I want to do life with you. I want to be about life together. And that, you know, that common experience and the desire to make a difference over time is very significant and just etches that person's image deeper and deeper into the recesses of our heart. That's a good point. Cindy, what do you think?
I was just thinking that probably the most motivating thing for me was that I was etched into someone's heart.
Sweet.
And Sweet. As shitty as I could treat her, she would still love me regardless. And I'd ask why, and it would be because, you know, my gratitude for God, you know, is great. Hmm. And that's and my motivation.
Pretty sweet point. Thanks.
I think that, you know, this is kind of tough for dudes to talk about, I guess.
I noticed that almost.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. It's like, it's women, women, women. A guy better say something.
There you go.
I think that as a part of it is we, you know, my experience, you're moving towards guys. You're investing your life in them. You're sharing your life with them. And I think to some extent that it's when the fire starts flying back, you keep pressing towards them. And I have a kind of a unique experience that most of my close friends are people that didn't like me initially. And that's, I'm exaggerating it, but you know, they didn't.
No, you're not.
That's yeah. that there was, you know, kind of an initial sort of caustic response. And then to some extent, my simple willingness to keep moving towards them despite that, resulted in, I think, some real wealth, not, you know, relational kind of experience. So I don't know. I think there's a part of it that it's like as we continue to invest and move towards other people, that there's a result of they've just become ingrained and they become the greatest treasures we have. So I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. Thanks. What do you think?
I had to get broken down to the point where I had to realize that I couldn't do it alone. Yes. I definitely needed like help and backup and advice that I could only have gotten from that.
That's right. So the cool thing is that you had that moment of time where you realize I'm screwed and I cannot do this.
It was the whole 5 days. It was horrible.
A pivot in your life's mm-hmm. direction. And I think that is what we're talking about here, is at some point we're coming to a point of decision. God, what is my life going to be about? Is it going to be about me, or is it going to be about you etching the names of people deep into my heart?
Because I had to
different way of living.
I almost had to get it knocked into my head.
Yes. Well, you are a thick-headed dude.
Thank you.
Which is cool.
Right here. I look back on my salvation the day I got it, and so much hope and love was filled in, and I have, you know, gratitude for the rest of my life.
Yeah, yeah.
And I look at people, and I want to share with them. I want them to experience the same hope and love that I had.
Yes.
And have, and it's overwhelms me with compassion for them.
Yes.
So as I pray for God's love to be a part of me, that I just see it in people. And when I see lost people, or people who are even found Christ but going through hard times, I want to encourage them and show them there's hope in their life. And I just will create bonds between people.
Yeah.
And I just want to chase it down and make a difference. And hopefully my humility and my hard times that I went through will make a difference in their life, and then they can do the same to others.
Yep. I think one of the big deals, as I've kind of thought this through in my own experience, is the need to sit down. We talked about this a little bit last week, and just express, you know, okay, God's got me in the life of this other person. And I need to think, you know, how does that person bear the image of God? Why am I thankful that person's in my life? And for some, that takes a lot of work and research. For others, it's a lot more clear. But if we don't view people from that perspective, I'm so glad you're in my life, and not in just some flowery, ethereal way, but a tangible and practical way, we will not let them in because we have not valued them sufficiently. And we've got to have a high view of people if we're going to be able to be servants of people and have their life really effective in that way. Lord, just thanks so much that we could be together here tonight and we could think about our adequacy and not like from the standpoint of strutting our feathers and trying to convince ourselves that we're somebody that we're not, but just by that ability to humbly come before you with all of our baggage to say, I'm not worthy, I'm really, you know, not adequate, God, but I trust that there is infinite adequacy available from you, that you seek to restore me to a relationship with you, that you seek to forgive me, and that really all you're asking me to do is receive the death of Christ as a substitute for the death that I deserve, and that in doing that, you will give me this new heart that you describe, that we are utterly acceptable to you, that we are fully adequate, Lord. And I just thank you for that platform to be able to stand on and look at life, because there's nothing that can be taken from our adequacy if it's rooted in you. And Lord, help us then to, you know, reflect that in our lives, in the relationships that we have, that we are all about your grace and your mercy. And help us, God, just to open our hearts to allow the real lives of other people to get etched deep within who we are so that we can, you know, really in a profound way, you know, be instruments of life to them. And I thank you, God, that this is not beyond anyone's capacity in this room. All of us can make dynamic inroads for you in this world simply by seeking to find our adequacy in you and to allow that standing that we have before you as a point of vulnerability to allow the lives of other people to affect us in this deep way. And I pray, God, as we leave here tonight and we interact together tonight, that these, you know, ideas would be tamped deep within our hearts, because these are such important issues for you. You want our lives to matter. They can matter in a profound way. And the truths are simple. The living out of it is difficult. Help us to come to an understanding of that in the situation that you've brought us to here tonight. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.